No, he left, did he? Okay, let's then prepare the field so we can see you on the holographic projection. Okay, wave. Good. Okay, stick your finger on your nose, or your thumb on your nose, and twiddle your fingers. Okay, good. Stick one finger in one ear and another finger on the top of your head and say red backwards. Good. Okay. Business. Business, business, business. The market and its continued erratic behavior. 8,200 goodness knows what at the moment. It's climbing. And this is due partly to the way the government is tied up. Now, something that I've noticed, and it's very entertaining to watch, is whenever there are political woes in the White House or in the Senate or in the House, the stock market does what? It climbs. And it's not just because of the positive figures that come out. It's due to the fact of that plus the fact that the government cannot interfere. Now, most of these people involved in these scandals actually have stocks and shares and bonds and dividends and commodities and so on, futures, all in the stock market. So, why does the stock market climb whilst the political turmoils go on? And this is because investors see it as the government is not able to interfere as much as normal when it's tied up with all its woes. Talking of woes, just a few weeks ago, there was a crisis, major crisis. And it was the Lewinsky tapes. Now it seems to be taking more of a backseat to other woes going on in the Middle East, Iraq mainly. Now it's funny that every time there are woes in the White House, some international crisis materializes. And depending on the severity of the crisis in the White House, depends on the severity of the international crisis. Have you noticed that, Russ?
Well, Paula Jones was in balance of the crisis internationally. It was about Iraq, but it wasn't taking where it is now.
Mm-hmm. In actual fact, there is no difference between now and the Paula Jones instances with Iraq. It's just that now is the time to take action, to do something about him.
Well, it seemed that they were almost asleep during the Paula Jones one.
That there was the thing going on with the inspectors and everything. But it was more along the lines of, well, sanctions, let's do sanctions, let's talk about it, let's see what we can get Saddam Hussein to do, let's move a few more troops into the area. But there wasn't the discussion on whether or not military action should be taken. Now, there is a discussion on military action. What should be done? Should we assemble a coalition of forces to go in there and attack and do something about it? And looking at how the two incidences in the past ran together and the severities makes me think that this time the crisis in the White House is major. Because now evidence is coming to light of not just a promiscuity, which is totally irrelevant and it's up to the individuals involved what to do, but the fact of tampering with evidence and lying, perjury. Tampering with evidence and perjury are two major no-nos. And what is happening with these, and you've got the kettle going?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What is going on is a sign that the situation in the White House is very dangerous. So, by diverting the attention away to this major crisis in the Middle East, which is no worse than anything else that's happened in the past, is diverting everybody's attention from what is going on. It's funny how that happens, isn't it? It's almost like manipulation, which it could be, could very well be. It's more than coincidence that every time that there is investigations going on, that something international happens.
What's going on with Whitewater?
Whitewater? That's still being investigated.
And what was happening nationally about Whitewater?
Well, nationally, I believe there was the...
Internationally.
Well, internationally, I think... I'd have to pull up my notes, which I don't have with me. I wasn't expecting you to ask me that question.
Oh. I don't remember there being any international crisis at the time.
Well, there were actually a few, not so much crises, but things going on. There was the planning and getting ready for the International Summit on Global Warming. There was the women's meeting. Because the Whitewater investigations have gone on so long, you know, we could actually sit down and pick out numerous international events and crises that were going on.
It's hard not to just say that those are normal part of a presidential kind of thing and not actually manipulated and taking the attention away from Whitewater.
But they were big headlines.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. They were big headlines that kind of pushed the Whitewater investigations to the background. However, kettle's boiling, so let's pause.
What's the tea?
Okay. Now, Whitewater has been dragged out so long, and the investigator, Kenneth Starr, is still active. Now, let's look at these supposed leaks. First of all, who is Kenneth Starr's boss? Do you know, Russ?
He's an independent prosecutor. He doesn't have a boss.
That's where you're wrong. He does have a boss. Who is head of the judicial investigation in your country?
Supreme Court.
Who is in charge of the Supreme Court?
That's the legislative branch of the government, which would be the I don't know how that works.
Who's in charge of the legislative side? Follow the chain up.
No, the president's in charge of the executive.
Mm-hmm.
Congress is in charge of the congressional side.
Mm-hmm.
And legislative side, it's not the president again, is it?
Mm-hmm.
It is?
Yeah, he's in charge of even the congressional side. He is the top man. He is the elected representative by the people. All the people. So it goes all the way to the top. He is the final person that has say-so. He has right of veto.
So you're saying the president's Ken Starr's boss?
Correct. It's like if you look at the structure up here. Okay, I'm a department head, right? I report to a member of the council. And that member of the council for Haley's base reports to whom? Correct. That's the way it works. He is, in actual fact, if you use the terminology that we have, he is the president. So these leaks coming out of the White House, out of Kenneth Starr's office, if indeed that is the case, looks very bad for Kenneth Starr. Now, the fact that Clinton is asking for Kenneth Starr to be investigated because of these leaks makes me think that he's trying to divert the attention again. Yeah, if he was to fire him, people would jump all over him for firing Kenneth Starr and say there is something going on here. But the fact that these so-called leaks are coming out of supposedly Kenneth Starr's office looks more like the fact that there's somebody that's being loose-mouthed in there and is blabbing, when in actual fact, that might not be the case.
Well, it might be the case, but it might be somebody the president put in there in the first place to do such a thing.
Correct. At the appropriate time when the situation became bad enough.
Well, for example, Lewinsky wants immunity.
Mm-hmm.
Can't start at night immunity.
Mm-hmm.
Now he's opinionated.
Mm-hmm. Which means she has to appear. And there will be negotiations, and there is a possibility that he may offer her immunity, depending on what transpires. Now, this is a little interesting thing. Why now are there so many leaks? Because the investigations are starting to touch the facts.
Well, the point is, who are the leaks to?
The press.
Which press? There's a lot of press.
Oh, crikey, I don't know offhand. It just seems to be all over the place at the moment.
For example, it's the Washington Post, as opposed to the New York Times. Washington Post is a liberal democratic newspaper, as opposed to the Times, which is a Republican conservative paper. Whichever one got the leaks would say who was actually in charge of making sure those leaks got to which paper.
Mm-hmm.
If it's the Post, the president did. If it's the New York Times, then might actually have something to do with the Republicans.
Might not be. Because what you have just said, think about it. The Democratic press, right, is liable to put the story on page 2, page 3, wherever. But if you want to get a leak out and get people to be thinking, where's this leak coming from? It's got to be coming from the office of Kenneth Starr. What do you do? Mm-hmm. Put it all together.
Well,
it's
basically means the president. As much power as he needs to wield at any point.
Now you're missing the point. Okay, let's look together at put the international incidences together, the leak, right? Or the leaks. Put those together, right? And what have you got?
No obstruction of justice.
Got tampering with justice. Big time. You've got, not only have you got perjury, tampering with evidence, that you've now got extortion and threatening behavior. Why do people do that?
Scared.
Why would they be scared?
Too close to the source.
Too close to the truth. They're starting to get to the truth. And it's a little too late, in my opinion. Okay, do you have any questions?
Not on this particular subject. I can't think of anything at all.
Okay, what about other subjects?
On astral projection. One of the keys is designing your body to be lighter than it actually is.
Kind of.
Astral body.
Correct.
Now, as such, you have to divorce your sensory input to nil so that you can feel your body become lighter than the substance around you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the problem you have is taking the sensory input and bringing it down to nil.
Mm-hmm.
What you really need to do is to focus the mind on one thing to such an extent that your sensory input no longer is mattering.
Correct. So basically what you're asking is, how do you do that?
Right.
Okay. Well, there's numerous different ways of doing it. One is cutting down external noise as much as possible. Cutting down on external lighting as much as possible. And cutting down on what you feel. That's the hardest of all.
Right.
Okay. That one you basically don't worry about. cutting down on the other two, the visual and the auditory, right, is simple.
It's just environment.
Correct. And if you're in a busy environment with lots of noise, what's the way of cutting down on the noise? And put earplugs in. And if it's a bright sunny day with lots of light streaming in through your window, what do?
Close the door, put on eye shades.
Or both. Sometimes people make a ritual out of it. You know, fasting, lighting candles, drawing the drapes, waiting till night. It's part of the reason why most people do a lot of astral traveling at night. Is because it's darker. There's less noise, there's less going on. So in doing so, it cuts down on a lot of the inputs and sensory stuff so that there's less things to do. By lighting the candles can have a hypnotic effect of the flickering of the candles.
Hmm. Or a fireplace.
Or even soft, relaxing music. Using things to focus on. Yeah, it's like your entertainment.
Trying to look around for help. That one there, with the guy with the white gloves and the big ears.
Uh-huh. I believe they talk about pure music in it. Pure music can give images into the mind, which help to a certain extent. Soft drumming or heavy drumming can induce vibrations within the body that help to focus on that.
Mm-hmm.
There are many, many different ways to do astral traveling. Some people like to use an induced altered state of consciousness. Other people like to use fasting, which again is inducing a change in consciousness. Some people like to use chemical aids to induce a change in consciousness. When you astral travel, basically what you're doing is altering your consciousness. You're altering from one reality to another.
Okay, the problem I've got is when I astral project,
mm-hmm.
I cannot divorce the feelings and sounds coming from around my body.
Have you tried the earplugs?
I've tried the different kinds of alternate sounds coming in.
Mm-hmm. Okay, do away with them. Do away with all sound.
So just earplugs.
Mm-hmm. You will hear your internal sounds, which can be concentrated on.
All right.
Why are
you guys going to do that one again?
Shredding the toilet paper?
Away from the toilet paper.
Hurr, hurr, hurr. Okay.
Anyway, I'll try the gun muffles.
Yeah. And probably some kind of, scarf over the eyes and everything to cut down on the light.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, love.
You're welcome. Hurr.
Greetings and felicitations, Russ, and how are you functioning?
I'm all well.
Okay. Last week, Tia's tantrum. Yes.
Your call.
Let's keep it.
As you wish.
Now, the reason behind the keeping of it is that it is showing caring and concerning in a very passionate way.
Well, which is the whole subject you got in the first place and brought it up.
Correct. The fact that she got very irritated and angry with the lack of respect as she sees it for your planet is something that needs to be understood. by other people. The fact that somebody that has never set foot on your planet has that much caring can be looked upon only as a positive. Okay, now, let us look at emotional outbursts. Emotional outbursts occur for numerous reasons. One is strong belief and conviction. Two is fear. Three is anger. Let us stop with those three. Strong convictions. Strong convictions serve the purpose of holding your opinion and making other people aware of your opinion. Emotional outbursts of the strong conviction kind come from the heart. The heart being a phrase used to explain deep-seated belief. These moral outbursts, being a sign of concern and passion on a subject, regardless of what the belief, are commendable. Because normally, they are showing the person as they really are, as they think and believe. Anger. Now let us look at fear first. Fear. Emotional outbursts from fear derive primarily from I am scared, I want to protect myself, I want to push the person away or the persons away however I can. If it means appearing to be angry, then so be it. So you could say a subcategory of fear, anger, as opposed to just plain anger. And these outbursts are normally because the situation is out of control. The person is out of control of the situation. And it can be physically threatening or life-threatening in some way. So we can put in another subcategory of fear of a life-threatening situation. And this is one of the most dangerous categories. Fear of a life-threatening or physical threatening situation. People in that situation that have emotional outbursts are unpredictable and dangerous. They would do almost anything to attempt to survive. So, let us call that subcategory number three. Fear survival. And that is probably the most dangerous category that I can think of. Not one of, but probably the most dangerous subcategory. And this is because the person is now bent totally on their survival. They will sacrifice anything to survive. No longer are they thinking in a loving, compassionate, clear way. Their judgment is now totally clouded. They are running on hormones and chemicals within their own body that have no control over their thought processes. They will harm people. They will harm themselves. They will cause destruction. That is why it is the most dangerous subcategory. Finally, emotional outbursts of the anger kind. Again, there are numerous subcategories involved in this. And we will quickly go through the categories. There is self-anger. Anger at another person. Disappointment anger.
and anger because of looking foolish. Now, looking foolish, everybody does that from time to time. I have done it to myself. After all, if I did not make mistakes, I would not look foolish. And I do make mistakes. I am not all-knowing, all-seeing. As much as I would like to be, I am not. I am not perfect. It has been a long time since I have been angry. As Ashar said, he mimics the emotion to get a point across, to get attention. So using anger can be a very useful tool if you mimic it, but do not get angry. If you act out the emotion, but keep yourself apart from that emotion. Self-anger. Self-anger is basically where you make a mistake, you know that people have seen you make the mistake, and you want to divert the attention away on a subconscious level. Sometimes it will make situations worse. Anger at somebody else because they have done something. That is a way of drawing attention to the problem and what has happened. Any questions?
Now, doesn't that with the most dangerous kind of anger, survival anger, isn't that kind of countered by an amount of love shown to that person?
Do you mean fear?
Yeah, fear.
Okay. At that point, there is no control over the emotion. There is no control over the emotional outburst. Let us take a situation as bad as we can.
Okay.
You are in an aircraft.
Right.
You have 2 parachutes, 3 people. You have your bondmate and one of your sons. Who gets to wear the parachutes?
I do, my bondmate.
What about your child?
I carry the money.
So you throw away 2 lives as opposed to 1?
No, parachute will carry 2 people as well as 1.
Let us say it does not.
I give up my parachute, my bondmate, and myself.
Most people would not do that on your planet. You can always have more children. You can always find a new bondmate.
Yeah, but I don't see life as being, this is my only life. It's going to be coming, I'll just come back. And, any show of, that, it just helps my evolution anyway.
Yes, but it could be wrong for you to do that. You have to weigh the odds. If the emotion just takes over and you are totally in fear, then you are not thinking correctly. Survival fear has, in the very wording, states that there is no control. Survival fear. Let us look closer at that phrase. Survival means to come through, to live through. And the fear. Fear is being very afraid of a situation. So survival fear is totally unpredictable. It is where the adrenaline is a stage beyond fight or flight. You have no control. You cannot make a clear, judgmental call on survival because your body is bent for one purpose and one purpose only, to survive. That is why it is called survival fear. You understand?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you saw that a lot back in Sirius when they went from third to sixth dimension. And they had 144,000 people in the pyramid, and you had thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people outside the pyramid, all trying to get in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, their whole thing was survival here.
Correct.
But that was because they, you know, didn't wish to die at that point.
Correct.
They had nothing. They couldn't look further than their own death.
Correct.
Which is not a six-dimensional way of looking at things.
You have to
look at it beyond your death.
Correct.
And what the you have to weigh the odds a little, what your death will bring about.
Okay, let us look at it another way. You are skiing. You hear a distant rumble above you. You look above you. You see the mountain coming down on you. All that white, beautiful, fluffy snow. What happens?
Transcend to the next level or to the next life.
Aren't you going to try and escape the avalanche?
Way faster than you are.
Maybe you can escape it. Maybe you're far enough to ski out of its way.
If you can see it.
Russ, don't take that approach of what is going to happen is going to happen. I am going to die, so I will not fight it. Maybe it is part of your growth to fight and survive. Don't do that approach. That is what you are doing is, it doesn't matter if I lose my life. That is not what it's about. If you throw away your life because you think you cannot survive, then you are not learning.
Well, let's take it to the next level then.
No, let us address this level first.
Well, I am. I mean, but the point of the fact is, okay, let's say I fight as hard as I can to stay alive, and yet I still die.
Then now, you have tried.
I have tried. But what's that going to do to my progression at that point? Do I then accept the
that
fact...
is besides the point.
Okay.
That is besides the point. The fact that you have tried. Instead of looking up and seeing the avalanche coming towards you and going, okay, I'm dead. I will sit here and meet my maker. You are dropping out on your obligations. Remember the discussion on obligations. To try to survive in a situation is the important thing because you may have a role to play in the future. Let us get back to the avalanche. Let us say that it happens tomorrow.
All right.
Right? And you sit down and go, okay, I am to die. I will die here. But planned in the future was a joining that would result in the offspring or a child that was to play an important role in the future of your planet. That you, in your waiting period, had planned to give birth to or to help conceive. The young lady in her waiting period with you had planned accordingly and had their life bent on that purpose. The offspring that was waiting in the waiting period for the appropriate moment to be conceived now has nobody in the group to help focus and point in the direction. So, you have now created a karmic problem. The mother of the child does not have the enjoyment and pleasure of raising that child. That child, in his waiting period, no longer has the structure that has been agreed upon. Or there is another alternative to look at. Let us say that you had agreed to meet somebody that you would give a life-changing experience to. That does not take place. So that karmic debt has not been paid. Or that action has not yet come to pass. So by giving up and not fighting and not using that survival instinct, the survival fear to survive, then you have caused karmic damage. However, let us say you are in a situation where you are, let us take the Titanic. You are on the Titanic. You know the ship is sinking. It is the last boat. There is a child. You put the child in the boat and therefore give up your seat, your chance to survive. That is possibly a karmic experience of ultimate sacrifice. Even in the lifeboat, you may die from exposure. So it is not a certainty that you will live. You may live, as in the avalanche. However, you are now sacrificing yourself for somebody else. How you react also depends on what has been discussed in the waiting period where you agree upon certain karmic debts that need to be paid and certain lessons. Maybe if you were on the Titanic and you took a spot that was supposedly for a child and you survived, you now have to live with that guilt. And that in itself could be part of the learning process. So you have to weigh the actions very carefully. You understand?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So doing the sit down and die routine is not a good way to go, because you are basically opting out of your karmic lesson. Trying to survive, even if death comes your way, is the obligation. Unless there is instinctual feeling that it is futile and you will die anyway. And then there is only one option left.
Well, can I ask a question, though, about somebody who is very highly evolved and yet chose that path out?
Okay.
Sananda.
What was his wording on his death?
Well, in his wording, he shows a sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
That he was dying for.
Forgive me, Father, for they do not know what they do.
Right. But yet he did not fight. I mean, even when Peter cut off the ear of the guard who came to take him,
mm-hmm.
he chastised Peter and said, this is my destiny. I have to do this.
The ear was actually cut off after the fact. Sananda had already been incarcerated and arrested at that point. He was sitting in the courtyard, and it was not a guard. It was somebody asking him. And the comment was, before the rooster crows three times, you will betray me.
Well, story gets mixed up.
Yes.
Okay, but he never fought. He never argued. He accepted his fate and went willingly to mm-hmm. his death.
But listen to the wording. Forgive them, Father, for they do not know what they do. He is giving absolution. Certainly he is not fighting. Certainly he is not arguing. Look at the situation. They had already planned his death.
Right.
If he had died violently, resisting arrest, what purpose would it have served? None. By his placid accepting of his fate, what did that do?
It taught valuable lessons.
Correct. And it created a myth around him. By offering absolution and standing and accepting his fate, what did that teach? Or what happened from that?
Well, the lesson passed into immortality.
Correct. Which in turn did what? It laid down a set of principles that has lasted
2,000 years.
Correct.
Okay. The point is, though, I don't see as any incarnate being could ever go willingly to their death. Unless, for example, as you say, the Titanic, they were sacrificing themselves. They'd always, the natural instinct of everyone is to fight for life. Correct. I mean, if the avalanche is coming, of course, I'm not going to sit down. I'll fight for my life. But correct. At some point, you know you're going to die. To accept your death in a form that you have no choice in the matter. For example, if you're going to be executed.
Which is what was going to happen to Samantha. There was no way out of that.
Right. Now, let's say if the avalanche is coming, I'm going to die anyway, and my friends are out of the path of the avalanche, and they're watching. And they see me fight and try to get out, but they see that all of a sudden there's no way I'm going to get out, and they see me instead accept my fate. Does that pass on into immortality as this man is? No, because I don't have the same destiny as he's did. But yet it will teach some lesson.
Yes, it will teach some lesson. Where death is unavoidable, then it is better to die either appearing to try to survive, because other people will look and say, well, he fought to the end. He was brave. If you sit down and try to avoid it, sit down and say, okay, I'm accepting my fate, that can be looked at two ways. One, hey, he just gave up. He might have made it. Or he died with dignity. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
Now, with the situation where it is inevitable.
Yeah, like the execution.
Like the execution. Then it is better to go with dignity. Because in dignity and standing before the execution squad, let us say you are going to be executed by a projectile weapon. If you stand up and they offer you a blindfold and you say, I don't need a blindfold, that has two effects. One is that you are facing your adversary face to face, eye to eye. And secondly, it portrays you as having a strong will. I am to die, I will die with honor and dignity. I will not be lashed to a post. I will stand tall and brave.
What?
Which is basically saying at the end, you may have captured me, you may have tried me, and you are planning to execute me, but you cannot take away my dignity. You cannot take away who I am.